I got nicked 4 times in the academy at Bristol. I was on the only player I think ever in rugby to have a good behaviour bonus in their contract. Eddie rang me and went, "Ginch, no, this is mate." And I was like, "No, Eddie fucking James."
I don't like some of the things that Clive Woodward write.
Yeah, you're not alone there, mate. I just see red when I go on the pitch, and I was so angry and ferocious, and I was getting scraps in game.
Do you think rugby's got a bit of a class problem?
It's definitely got a class problem, yeah. Yeah.
This is Upfront with me, Simon Jordan. I believe there are a lot of vacuous, uninformed, unchallenged opinions out there. I want to get to the bottom line and cut through the nonsense. So on this podcast with William Hill, I'm going to get people with strong views who think they can stand them up under proper scrutiny. There's a good chance I might learn something along the way, but more importantly, so might you. Joining me in today's episode, a top England rugby international who in recent times won the Premiership title with Leicester Tigers, before returning to his roots with Bristol. His rise comes via an unconventional rugby beginnings. Overcoming personal and social challenges, he's gone on to become a leader for club and country. Liz Genge, welcome to Upfront.
Thank you for having me.
Nice to see you. We share two passions we've just been discussing off air, haven't we?
Yeah, very odd.
Paddle tennis, but more importantly, the Specials,
yeah,
and ska music. It's music to my ears, that was, because ultimately I'm a big Specials fan. As I was telling you off air, you know, I was very much involved in the reformation of the band. So it's really nice to meet someone that actually appreciates my endeavours of getting them back together again.
That's it.
But it was your dad, wasn't it?
Yeah, my
man's dad was ska music.
Yeah, big, loves it. Loves everything to do with ska.
Fantastic music, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Listen, Ellis, in these discussions that we have with all you elite athletes, one of the things that we try to get to understand is kind of the journey that you've been on and what took you and what made you do the things that you've done. But like boxing, rugby sort of intrigues me because you guys are in the hurt business. And so there's a lot of synergies. And one of the things that the boxers all seem to come from was a background of adversity and challenges and difficulties in their childhood. Looking at your backgrounds, you come from what seems to be a slightly challenged background, primarily because of maybe your behaviour and some of the way you viewed the world. But just tell me a little bit about that background.
So traditionally, you see a lot of those stories. People are from broken homes. And
single parent homes, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. My parents were together. Yeah. By no means did we have it easy. And we definitely aren't from an affluent family and didn't have a penny to scratch our ass with. But I'm not from a broken home at all. Like my parents, the house was full of love and didn't have much, but yeah, we had a blast. And I came from a place called Norwest in Bristol. Mm-hmm. So back in the sort of 70s, 80s, 90s, it was a bit of a torrid place to live.
Right.
I'm a 95 child, although I look about 40. So I probably missed the worst of Nol. The area is sort of always predominantly white. My granddad's black.
Right.
His dad came over from America.
Because your mum's mixed heritage.
My mum's mixed, yeah.
And your dad's white,
My dad's white, yeah. Skinhead, big scar man.
Okay.
It wasn't easy, but definitely not a traditional rugby background.
But what's this about you didn't want? I mean, I'm reading a quote from you, which says, "I didn't want anyone to help me. I didn't want to be part of anything." What's that about?
I couldn't write. I'm dyspraxic, so my handwriting was awful. I found out when I was 14, right. So quite late on. So 2 years of school, the teachers thought, "Fuck me, this bloke just don't want to do any work." But it was actually because I wrote like 3 words per minute or something, which was awful. So whenever teachers would come in and try and help me, I always thought they were being condescending or patronising and sort of taking a piss out of me, I guess. And because obviously I'd experienced, I guess, a bit of abuse in the school life before coming to secondary school, I probably thought, "Fuck me, everyone's on my case again." And like my mum done a great job of keeping me in line in terms of like when I was in Nol growing up and that, always correcting me. I was the only kid in the area that wasn't allowed out past 7 o'clock until the 8. Do you know what I mean? So I was "Fuck me, why is everyone trying to pull me down?" And the teachers were very different to me. I didn't have anyone that I could relate to in the slightest at the time. And then when we became an academy, we actually brought in, which was the only black teacher at the school at the time, called Lloyd Russell, who was a black belt in karate. He was a world champion actually. And he really helped me. He really helped me. And that was actually, ironically, when I got told I wasn't allowed to come in for half the day, but in the same breath, I actually started to enjoy it a lot more.
Where was sport in this for you?
Sport, I started playing rugby, I think, year five, year six, what's that?
So what's that, 11?
11, yeah, I think. Loved it, to be fair, but I left school, which was where my friends were, in Nol. And then I went to John Cabot.
Right.
So then I started playing football as a goalkeeper. I was all right.
That's where they put the ones that can't play in it.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. The people, my defender took my goal kicks, mate. So that says everything you need to know, doesn't it? I was that kid. So I pat football in and started playing rugby. I was a lot bigger than everyone and stronger. I was just more genetically advanced than everyone. Yeah, exactly. So I did that and a bit of shot put. So
where was your parents in this? Was your father and your mother behind you in this? Did they look at this as something that A, you enjoyed, B, it kept you focused on something positive, and then C, hey, there might be something in this for you?
I don't think they thought I was going to get a career until I was about 16, I'd say. My mum always wanted me to be happy, and I was happy when I was playing, you know? So,
yeah.
And I think it brought discipline. On Tuesdays, we'd train on the evening, so that'd keep me off the streets.
Yeah.
When all my mates were out causing mischief, I was at training. And then on Sundays as well, when you got fuck all to do and you go out, I was playing rugby. So, and it gave me something to get after. And I was naturally quite lazy when I was younger. I didn't want to do much. I just wanted to go out with my mates and do whatever we were doing. And rugby, gave me a bit of direction, something to get after. And I think they seen that and they were incredible. My mum worked till six. She was an admin. And my old man, self-employed plumber with the council, and then became self-employed. So he was a bit more flexible. And he'd leave work early to come and drive me an hour to the other side. But I missed a lot of training, naturally, because they were working all the time, whereas the other kids had they were all at the same school, so they could share lifts and all that.
What you said a moment ago about at 16, you started to realise it might be an opportunity. What was it about 16 that was defining in your mind as saying, oh, hang on a second, I'm 16. Is it because you got picked up by a club? Is it what happened at 16 that started to define in your mind?
I left Cleveland when I was 15, went to Keynsham when I was 16. I was playing centre at the time and I'm a prop now. So the disparity between the two is very different. Like I said, I was athletic, I was fast.
Yeah.
I scored 5 tries in the Somerset Cup final, which, to be fair, wasn't the best standard. But off the back of that, I think there was a scout there, put me forward for South West trials. I got in like last second. They sent me an email saying, you're not supposed to be in, but you're in. Thanks, like, made me feel great about myself, do you know what I mean? We stayed there, had to stay away from home for one night and play these trial games. And, it was horrible. It was horrible. Didn't get on with anyone. Hated it. And then I didn't get into the England 16 setup off the back of that. And I thought, fuck me, my world's over.
Right.
So I went and hit the bricks with my old man for the summer, working for a few of his mates. Continued to do the academy stuff with Bristol. But I went to Hartbury College on a scholarship. Because after I got let go from England, obviously I was fuming. Literally thought the world was over. And a few boys in my position who got called in, I thought were crap. So I was like, this is...
How's this working out? Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? Like, it wasn't adding up.
But what were you like? I mean, when I speak to some of these guys, I speak to like Michael Owen as a footballer and other people. They were very strong in their belief that there was going to be success awaiting them. How steadfast were you in your belief that hang on, you know, I'm good enough to be here and I will be here and it's a moment, it's just a moment in time until I get there?
I didn't really see it.
You didn't see it?
No, I didn't see it. My mum did. My mum was like, you're good enough, you're better than all these. But I thought, right, she's just being a mother, do you know what I mean? She's just trying to fill me with confidence. My old man was the other way. He actually said, like, think about doing something else.
Right.
Because I was putting everything into it, everything that I was capable of in my capacity at the time. Trying to go for it as well as I can. I just fell short, obviously. And at 16 as well, you're going through puberty and emotions are high. Do you know what I mean? You ain't got a clue what's going on.
So if you were unsure and your mother believes that you've got the talent and your dad's being level-headed about it and saying, give yourself a safety net, right? When did you look at it and go, hello, no, actually, I do have the belief in myself. So this is for me.
Off the back of that, we went on a rugby tour with my club side, Keynsham at the time. And that was it. And then just after that, there was a college called Hartbury where I went and played my college rugby between 16 and 18. And apparently there was this scout going to watch Colston's, which is a private school in Bristol. And Keynsham organised a friendly against Colston's so that the scout, Alan Martinovich, great coach, coached me for years, was going to watch that game. And I wasn't going to play.
Right.
I wasn't going to play. But one of the players in that team, the private school Colston's, got put into that England setup. And I didn't. Right. So I went, fuck it, I'll play. And I had an amazing game, scored tries, ran amok, you know?
Right.
And Alan, off the back of that, walked up to my mum on the side of the pitch and said, I'll give him a scholarship. He can come to Hartbury next year. And I was like, fucking hell.
Right.
And it was as simple as that. And then I went to Hartbury, which was at the time a breeding ground for internationals. We had 17 schoolboy internationals in my age group alone. And yeah, I just went from this player that was raw and low on confidence to it just, oof, just transcended.
Tell me about dyspraxia. I mean, you mentioned it a moment ago and how it impacted upon you at school because of the challenges you had with writing. But what about the challenges it would have for you in sport? Because it's a coordination challenge, isn't it?
It is, yeah. And the thing with dyspraxia is it can affect people differently. So for me, it's more judgment of space. So like, for example, my handwriting, it wasn't very neat at all, but I'd always write off the lines and stuff like that. I'd always walk in stores, I'd drag my feet along the floor and my trainers were always rets and stuff like that. So, but when I played rugby, I barely passed anyway, if I'm being honest, because I'm good at carrying. So I just thought, fuck it, I ain't got to pass the ball, so I ain't got to work on that. But when I went to Hartbury, all these great coaches and players there, you actually spent time with cameras like this on slow-mo passing and learning how to pass. Before that, I'd done zero passing work ever. So I went there on a scholarship. I couldn't even pass the ball. But all these cameras and I worked it, I worked it. I'm still not the best passer of the ball in the world now, but I'm fueled by, at that time, by anger.
Yeah, I was going to say, by rage. Yeah,
by rage and...
By the way, what anger and what rage?
Just jealousy.
Of what?
Everyone else, everything that they had and the people that I was playing against, given ample opportunity and I was given fuck all. So I always felt, because I was sort of dragged through the dirt to get there, that I had to...
What do you mean by that? You mean you've got a loving family?
I've got a loving
great
family.
Support. So what are you being dragged through?
When you go to trials, you were looked at very differently for being from where I was from. I didn't know anyone there, right? So imagine this, one of probably a few mixed race people have turned up to this trial, which probably, do I think they were thinking that? No, but I'm different to them anyway. I speak very differently to most people with a thick Southwest accent. I had a slit in my eyebrows, stars shaved into the back of my head. Do you know what I mean? I'm in a full tracksuit. I ain't got gym shoes, all that sort of stuff. We've turned up in a 03 4 Focus, you know what I mean? So everyone else is in a nice Range Rover and that. So when I turn up, automatically I'm blaring out Kanye West and bobbing my head and these kids are all in their groups already.
So it's without being rude.
No, it's fine.
It's a little bit of an inferiority complex.
Absolutely. I felt like I didn't belong and that would make me think, fuck it, if I don't belong, I'm going to show them why I should belong.
Yeah.
So, and that was my mum all the time, driving to all these trials. You fucking show them today, you let them know. And even if you don't get it, make sure they remember it and stuff like that. So I still use it now and again. But I'd say that's more insecurities in performance. If I'm not playing well, I try to go back to that because it then comes naturally.
Yeah.
As opposed to thinking. Because when I think that's when I start to probably drop off.
You land at Bristol Bears, right? And you're in their academy. You find yourself in a situation where you're on the wrong side of the law.
Mm-hmm.
And you're getting yourself into scenarios that seem to be potentially taking away from the opportunity that you're creating from yourself.
Mm.
In your situation, what I've understood is that you've got involved with things, you can tell me yourself if you want to, on the wrong side of the law, whether that's drugs or whatever else it is. But you're on your journey.
Mm.
You're in an academy. You're on the way. And Kell Brook, the fighter, talked to me. I said to him, why do you get yourself in fights? You're the WBC or IBF welterweight champion of the world. You're getting stabbed in Ibiza.
Mm.
How are you getting in situations like that? And he said something along the lines of, you can take the council house, you can take the boy out of the council house, but you can't take the council house out of the boy.
Similar, we say you can take the boy out of the west, but can't take the west out of the boy.
So what's going on with you then in this situation? Is it that?
Yeah, I'd say similar stuff to that. And to be honest, I think at the time, especially like you imagine, right? I've gone from sweet fuck all in terms of never been in these professional environments, never been to these amazing facilities and that. And suddenly I'm chucked in it deeper and living away from home at the age of 16. All my mates are back home selling drugs, fighting, wearing nice clothes, buying shoes, riding in cars at the age of 16. I'm seeing all this. Social media started to become a thing. And so I'm seeing all this. I'm thinking, fuck me, I want to do that. You know, that looks fun. I'm here training at 7 o'clock in the morning, 4 days a week. And staying up here on weekends in Gloucester, a place I didn't necessarily call home. And then I got into the academy. I was getting paid, I think it was $5,000 to start with. And then we went in and said, look, I need a bit more. So they gave me $7,500 a year. I had to fund my own driving lessons. Like, the club didn't help us out with that. Insurance at the time for an 18-year-old who had to put down legally professional rugby player was like $4,000. So that's half my salary out the window already. But they wanted you to be this well-oiled machine and buy all your grub and have discipline. But I was looking at my mates who were earning thousands of pounds selling drugs and having a blast, going to parties, drinking, doing everything that I wanted to do. And I'm thinking, fuck me, I'm skint, training right. to be a rugby player. I can't see the carrot. I couldn't see a carrot, do you know what I mean? So,
where's the positive influences around you? Because the carrot is, you can see it in front of you. You can see, this is 10 years ago, aren't we? We're talking about 10, 11 years ago?
12, yeah.
12 years ago. So we're talking about post the England winning the World Cup. Rugby is a major sport. It's beginning to get a little bit money, more money in it. So where's the positive influence? Your parents would have been a positive influence in your
they
life.
They were brilliant. They were brilliant. Yeah. They deterred me from a lot of trouble. Mum always first one to the cells to get me out whenever, or take me down in some situations. Old man was a bit more to stick. Like he'd come down hard on me, but I think I needed it.
Yeah.
Needed that. Which I think most young boys probably do need a positive male role model in their life. And he was brilliant. But at the same time, you've got to remember he's working, he's self-employed, he's trying to provide for my sisters, my mum, and everyone else. So he hadn't got time to be worrying about me. And then in their defence, my friends were brilliant. They were brilliant. They said, look, you ain't missing fuck all here. Like, there's nothing going on. Yeah, it looks great, but think about it in the long run. So, yeah, they pushed me away from a lot of stuff.
Given the fact that you captain, you end up as vice-captain of England and captain of Leicester, would you consider yourself to be a leader or a follower? Because you're following people into a shitty way of life that is taking them to tell you not to do it. And I'm trying to establish, because I mean, listening to you, and you've got strong character, looking at your career over the last 3 or 4 days and the things that you've achieved, but you don't strike me as a follower, yet the things that you're saying to me now suggest that at a time, as a younger man, you didn't know yourself and you might have been a bit of an easily
led astray.
Influenced, led astray.
Yeah, I wouldn't say I've ever been a follower. I've always wanted to feel a part of something.
Right.
That's what I've always craved. I've always wanted to feel a part of something. I think that's why rugby took me so strongly.
Right.
Because obviously you're a part of a club, you're a part of a team, but I was a part of a gang. I was a part of these young, we were 14, 15, and I was a part of that and I felt these are my boys. I never want to leave it. I was so short-sighted in where the world was. It didn't go outside of BS4 for me when I was younger. And then suddenly I've seen all these mental schools and all these mental cars. You know, that was what triggered it, I guess.
Did that intimidate you? Did it make you look at... when you're looking at great wealth or what you consider to be great wealth by comparison, did it intimidate you in any shape or form? Did it make you feel like you didn't belong?
I used to call it putting the blinkers on. So when I turn up somewhere and I feel like that, I'd literally just be like that. I wouldn't look at anyone, wouldn't keep eye contact with anyone. Wouldn't chat to anyone, which obviously then all the selectors and that when I was growing up, it changes when you get to the elite level, but they're all thinking, well, fuck me, this kid don't want to be here. Look at his body language. I had that for years. Poor body language. And I think it was just because of the way I was, the way I looked, as opposed to what I was actually doing on the pitch, you know?
Were you close to stealing defeat from the jaws of victory? Because you're on your way now. You're in Bristol. You're getting yourself into a situation where people are recognising your talents. And this other side of things, this period of time where you're getting your collar felt and you're getting pulled out of prison cells and whatever else you've got, were you close to missing the opportunity that you've now taken?
Yeah, I was on a knife's edge, really. We lost one of our mates when we were 14 to a hit and run. And he actually played rugby and he loved it. So every time I would go back then, I got one friend called Luke who would say, no, do the rugby. I remember that when we were young. And I think that boys having that trauma, that impact on them, that's probably what made them keep pushing me to leave it. But yeah, countless times. I mean, I got nicked 4 times in the academy at Bristol. I was on the only player I think ever in rugby to have a good behaviour bonus in their contract, which consisted of not getting arrested and not getting into fights at training. Do you know what I mean? I'm fucking eight. Who the fuck has a £500 bonus in their contract for not getting nicked? But that's where I was at. I was just, and I think like you said, I was battling with feeling a part of something. It wasn't until I let my guard down and really became invested in a team that I started to see firstly success in rugby and secondly actually be a bit happier off the pitch.
You talked about not belonging. I mean, how difficult was it for you to make sure that you used the emotion of whether it was anger or resentment or a feeling of being an outlier and an outsider, to use that in the right way in sport?
It was tough because back then, and similar to when I started to put the blinkers on, I just see red when I go on the pitch and I was so angry and ferocious, and I was getting into scraps in games and always at people and chirping, and I was horrible to play against, but I wasn't channeling my energy in the right way.
Right.
So I worked with some sports psychs, and to be honest, the best mentors for me were the players. I don't know how familiar you are with them, but the South Sea Islander boys, all the Polynesian boys, who are absolute yep. fucking animals.
Right.
And they hit hard, they carry hard, they are monsters, aggressive men, but they're so quiet and calm when they do it.
Mm-hmm.
They weren't letting people know, weren't leaving a bit on them, you know? Yeah. Like, whereas I was, and I had a mentor called Jack Lamb, good friend of mine, lived with him. He was 27 at the time, I was 18. He paid my rent, put me in a place, paid for all my food. And he was like, look, I'll bring you in, but there's a few rules. He was like, you stop going out on the piss and getting arrested. And he was brilliant for me. So I owe a lot to Jack.
Was leaving Bristol a key definer for the changing of your thought processes, moving you away from things that were around you and from some of the challenges and choices that you may have had and moving you somewhere else?
Well, yeah, I think when I was at Bristol, as I said, I had that good behaviour bonus, and I think it was one step forward, two steps back. And I felt like I should have been playing, but I was very young at the time and there were a few players playing ahead of me. And I remember the sort of turning point was we were in training, we were playing a conditioned game, and one of the players that was in my position slapped one of the other players. And I just thought, fuck it, I'm going to let him have a few. So I hit lumps out of him and he couldn't play that weekend because he had a cut under his eye. So I got brought onto the bench, made my debut. And then the week later, they sent me on loan for a few weeks to get me out of there. And then the opportunity to Leicester came.
Right.
So you imagine now I'm thinking I should be playing anyway. I've just played, made my debut. Now they've sent me on loan.
You play for Bristol Bears.
Mm.
You then go out for loan for two seasons.
You've got a club that's local to Bristol in the National League. So yeah. A lot lower level, not professional. You go on, train with them, loan there, play there, then come into train with Bristol in the week. And you train with them on the nights.
Right.
So it's full on. And I was on loan there for two seasons.
But you seem to have gone into Bristol, made an impact. This is what I've read, right? You made an impact. Then you go out and loan back to Bristol, make 14 appearances. Bang, Leicester come in for you. You go to Leicester, you make one appearance. Bang, you're in the England squad.
Mm.
I mean, that's pretty remarkable.
Well, it went quickly for me. So like you said, I debuted for Bristol. Then I went on loan to Plymouth and I was there for three weeks. They hadn't won a game. They went into liquidation. I remember being in the gym. I got water up to my knees because it was flooded. Like it was a tough place to be. And then Leicester came with the offer to buy me out of my contract. But that was off the back of all the shit going on with me at the club in Bristol and repeatedly getting arrested in the season. Yeah. And they were like, I think they were at the time probably glad to see the back of me. In the club's defence, I did shake hands with Chris Boy at the time, the chairman of the club, and he said, like, we'll see you back in the future. And I was like, yeah, I feel like Bristol's my home. I probably will be back. But Leicester at the time, it was notorious for being hard-nosed and some of the toughest players to ever play the game, Manu Tuilagi, Tom Youngs, all these big bruisers of men. So I've gone there, and now you think I've reset again now.
Well, that's what I'm going to read you back the quote again, which is what you said, which is, I went to Leicester and I got humbled very quickly. And I'm curious about that because you sat here telling me that you struggled to fit in and found difficulty in being accepted and challenged yourself mentally. And then you go on to say, I got stripped back down to the bare bones and built back up. So what does that mean? What does getting humbled mean very quickly? And what does it mean to say you got stripped back down to the bare bones and built back up?
Well, that year, so that was a 2015-16 season. I went out on loan. I played for England under-20s. We won the Six Nations. The under-26 nations, came second in the World Cups. New Zealand, I featured in that heavily, thought I was playing really well. So I thought, yeah, world's at my feet. I'm best player alive sort of thing, this young prospect. All Leicester Tigers want to buy me out my contract. How good am I sort of thing?
Yeah.
I turn up.
Was it an economically good move for you?
Yeah.
Was it good dough?
What did I do? I tripled my salary.
Right, okay.
So I was on 20K at Bristol. With that £500 good behaviour bonus. And I went to Leicester for 40 and then 60, two-year contract. So it was brilliant money for a 20-year-old boy. Anyway, I've gone there. I thought, fucking hell, I'll be straight in the team. I'll play straight away. And yeah, I was very wrong. I realised very quickly I didn't train hard. I played hard. I didn't train hard.
Right.
So I found out, yeah, very fast. And in my first week there, I got filled in by about five of the senior boys in a training session. So that was what I mean when I said I got humble, because like I said, I've come in.
It was a reality check.
Yeah, I was like, fuck, I'm bad boy from Noel, you know, right. I thought my shit didn't stink. Went into training, yeah, and I got lumps it out of me. And then, but the club was amazing. It was amazing because that happened and I was covered in claret and Richard Cockerell, another lunatic, the coach at the time, come up to me, he said, brilliant, Genji. And I was like, fucking hell. I just got into a scrap with five of the boys my first week here. And the coach was saying, brilliant, if I did that at Bristol, I wouldn't be allowed to train for 2 weeks. You know what I mean?
Right.
So now I'm seeing people embrace me as opposed to try to sort of suppress what I love, the fire, the passion, the fight. I loved it. That was what I played rugby for. And now this club wants to embrace it. So he come up to me and said, brilliant.
And then channel it.
And then channel it. And he said, brilliant. Now you're going to hit the next scrum. Mm-hmm. And I was like, well, I'm covered in fucking blood. Can't I go and are you going to hit the next scrum? So I've gone into the next scrum. He went, nice. Now go get cleaned up. He brought me into the office. He said, mate, he said, what you're going to learn there very quickly is like, we love that. Like, we love the fire. We love the fight. As long as you train hard, play hard, and you're not a knobhead, basically, we'll look after you. So, and
so that gave you a sense of belonging, didn't it?
Oh, mate, straight away. Like, even the boys who are just hit 10 shades of shit out of me, they come up to me after, shook my hand. Tom Young's not club captain at the time, Ed Slater was. Tom Young sent me a text on the night, but I remember ringing my old man and telling him what happened. And I was in Leicester, now 2.5, 3 hours away from home. And he was like, fucking hell, mate, straight away. Why are you doing that? Blah, blah, blah. And then Tom Young sent me a message with a picture of his face. And he had a few bruises on his face from where we were fighting. And he went, call you caught me well, Bab. See you tomorrow. And I said to my dad, I said, he's just fucking text me. He was like, brilliant. He said, go in tomorrow. First thing you do, shake his hand. So I went and shook Tommy's hand. He went, just come off a Lions tour. Do you know what I mean? He's one of the best players in the world in his position. And he's saying that to a 20-year-old who's just come from a championship.
And now you're getting
club.
The acceptance you wanted as well, yeah.
And I straight away just felt like I belonged. So I then gave everything for the club for the foreseeable, yeah.
And you started a relationship with Steve Borthwick.
I did. He actually came to Bristol in 2015 and then left Bristol within, I think, 3 months, 4 months to then coach Japan with Eddie.
Right. Nothing to do with your bad behaviour.
He was coaching Japan. No, nothing to do with my behaviour. Although I did get arrested when Steve was there, which probably wasn't a good start. Steve was with Eddie at Japan at the end of that World Cup cycle in 2015. Came to Bristol in the champ. We met. I loved him. I don't know if he loved me at the time, but got on really well. He was a great coach. He then left to go to England. And then, as you said, 6 months later, I'd played, debuted against Bath, and I was in England set up. So we're working together since then.
This relationship with Borthwick, I mean, he was the coach when you lifted that premiership trophy. You said when you first met him that you loved him.
Mm.
Why did you love him? What was that about?
Because he gave me the time of day. And although at the first time we met each other, I was a delinquent in the academy, probably doing his head in, ruining training sessions, he didn't treat me any differently to anyone else. He didn't see me differently to any of the other players. We had internationals at the club at the time, British and Irish Lions at Bristol at the time. But Steve would treat me with the same amount of respect that he treated them. And it's rare, I think, especially as an academy player in rugby, to find someone like that. So automatically I thought, fucking hell, I'll fight for this bloke.
Mm. You're a mainstay in England rugby squads. You're the captain of the Premier League winning side. And you leave and rejoin Bristol. And not only do you leave and rejoin Bristol, you take a big pay cut. Why would you do that?
Leicester offered me a 3-year deal on great money. I didn't accept it straight away. And I thought, why haven't I accepted a 3-year gig with a club I love? I've been here 6 years. I've got a house up here. My dog, my son's been born here. Missus is up here. My mum and dad love the club. We know it like the back of our hand. Ultimately, they gave me my success. And I had to think about it. And that obviously brought up a few red flags.
Like what?
Well, I went away and I said to my old man, I said, like, Leicester have offered me a new contract. He said, fucking hell, brilliant.
Get in.
Yeah, happy days. It's all going so well. You're starting for England. You're captain of the club. You've got a chance to lift silverware this year. I said, yeah, but I don't know if I want to stay. And he was like, why? And my nan was ill at the time. God rest her soul. Had a few things going on with family, and I could see that for my family at the time, and I'm sure you've had decisions to make like this yourself, for my family at the time, I knew deep down it would have been a selfish decision for me to stay in Leicester. It would have been a career-driven decision, and ultimately, possibly, that would have probably gave my family better opportunities in the future. But for happiness away from sport, I knew that my family would be happier in Bristol. My son could be brought up closer to his grandparents and the rest of his family, my nieces, my nephews, my missus' nieces and nephews. I had a second child on the way. I wanted her to be brought up in Bristol. I know the area. Although I knew Leicester very well as two, I knew that I'd always want to go back, and the opportunity...
They must have bit your arm off, mustn't they?
Bristol?
Yeah.
it's a difficult one. I had the discussions
maybe
with them.
Maybe they had to pay the good behaviour bonus and stuff like that. Yeah.
It was a bit steeper at the time as well. But they finished 11th, I think, the year that we won the Prem, or maybe 10th.
Right.
So they probably thought, fucking hell, we need someone. And Bristol were big, which I love, on having Bristolians playing for the club.
Okay.
Local talent playing for England. And I'm the only Bristolian playing for England. So for them, marketing-wise and business-wise, it's probably an easy decision. Mm-hmm. But yeah, as you said, I took a pay cut. It wasn't hundreds of thousands of pounds, but I knew my family would have been happier. And for me at the time, I thought, fuck me, I've had my missus up here for years. My kid's been up here. I want them to go home and settle in now.
Can I ask you about rugby per se and the structuring of rugby? Do you think, I mean, Eddie Jones made some observations about the structure of rugby, and I kind of half agreed with what he said. And he got lambasted, he got slaughtered by the establishment when he turned around and said, if kids only come from private schools with that background, then they don't have the toolkit to overcome adversity because everything's handed to them, given to them in a certain way. And I kind of half understood what he was saying. And he got a lot of shit for it. And I agree that if you don't have adversity in your life and everything is handed to you, even though rugby to me is a fucking difficult sport, then you lose out on a certain set of characteristics, that ability to dig deep. Do you think rugby's got a bit of a class problem?
It's definitely got a class problem, yeah. Yeah.
What do you mean by that?
Well, I've seen it firsthand. Over the years, as I said, when I was going to the trials and stuff. So at a younger age, the kids who miss out on becoming a professional rugby player, I would say, is massively down to the class divide in the sport. It's really tough to explain unless you've seen it firsthand, because...
Do you mean class divide because of the
absolutely, money? Yeah, financially. Yeah. I'm strictly talking financials. I think if you're a nice enough bloke and you ain't causing problems anywhere you go...
You're getting opportunity, yeah.
In terms of, I'm talking rugby boots, for example, and all the kit and the hours that you got to drive, the festivals, the schools, because ultimately the private school's got the best facilities, the best coaches go and coach there. They're going to produce better talent, I get that. But athletically and in terms of raw talent, I know where that is. I know where the raw aggression, the natural talent, the kids who are hungry to get out of where they're from, I know where that is, and that is in the areas that are deprived.
Would you say, given your experiences in life, it actually puts you in a better position than the people that Eddie Jones is pointing at? You follow me?
I understand exactly what he's saying. I think Eddie's one of those. He's similar to myself. He didn't get everything handed to him. He spoke openly about experiencing racism when he was growing up in Australia, and he played in a tough league over there. And he actually played at Leicester as well in the front row, which was a tough position to play in the era that he played in. So I think Eddie had a rough ride in. So naturally, as a coach, he probably favours the people who are abrasive, aggressive and front foot things. What I will say on the situation is...
He's basically saying that when you've come from this public school background, when you've got a silver spoon and you've been given everything, he's kind of saying you've got no bollocks when it comes down to it. When the going gets tough, you need people that have got the ability to overcome adversity. And if you've been given everything and everything comes from a privileged background, you might have the toolkit, you might have the physical attributes, but you haven't got this when it gets going.
The mental nous.
Yeah.
I know what he means. And it's because when he's coaching, I think the generation's different now. Like when I was younger, as I spoke about, being in the academy at a club, you got given fuck all. It was hard, you know. The senior players wouldn't even fucking look at you most of the time until you were in your stripes. Whereas now...
But are you better for it?
Of course I am, yeah.
So that means that you've got an advantage.
So I think it's been failed almost, within reason. And I think what Eddie's speaking about is some of the kids that came through and got given opportunities very early probably didn't have that mental resilience of getting knocked back a few times and having to get back up, getting knocked down again, and then getting dragged through, as I said, you know. But some of the best players in the world have come from the background that he's talking about, and they're fucking lovely blokes as well, and I love playing with them. Yeah. So
it's not one size fits all.
No, it's not, no. But I totally understand what you're saying. Even me now, like when I see some of the youngsters and I chat to them, I think, fuck me, mate, you've got a big shot coming your way. they fell once and like you said, they don't know.
Can't
what,
get up again.
Yeah, like a rabbit in headlights, don't know what's going on.
But did the sport, because it's interesting in football, and it's a comparison between when you've got highly educated, what seems to be highly educated, coming from well-heeled backgrounds, they get ridiculed and out and sort of ostracized in football. So I'm thinking of Graham Lasso.
Yeah.
Are you saying that the polar opposite exists in rugby? If you don't come from elite background, you didn't go to one of the elite schools, your parents don't drive a Range Rover, and you aren't as well educated perhaps as someone that's been through the private school system, that you have the same experience?
Yes, definitely when I was growing up, but I experienced it firsthand. I don't necessarily know if it's like that anymore because it's been highlighted. I think people probably have recognised it and it's changed a little bit. The dynamic has changed.
Right.
What I would say in football is when you're young, and I'm not too clued up on it, but I see people get signed at 8 years old, 9 years old, 10 years old, right? Their talent...
Because the infrastructure's there.
Their talent ID and the infrastructure is grassroots from the bottom. They know if there's a good player playing for a club from 6, 7, 8, right? Whereas in rugby, you find Alex Donbrandt, I'll give as an example. I think he signed his first contract after he finished university, hit 22, I think. And he's one of the best number eights in the Premiership now. Do you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
So that talent ID isn't necessarily there. The pathways are very different. I don't think you'll find one of the best players in the Premiership in football having to have gone to university and get scouted there and do it the hard way in that sense.
What about representation in sport? You talked about the issue in rugby as it's been a white man's game for a number of years.
Mm.
There's not really many black coaches or ethnic coaches, especially in England. I don't think people are commercialised, especially the black and African boys in rugby or women. To be icons, we're not presented like that. What do you mean by that?
Well, what I was alluding to, and I spoke briefly earlier about Lloyd Russell, the teacher that came to my school and the impact that had on me, having a black teacher at the school who could relate to instances that I've been through.
Did you need to see it to be it? Is that what you're saying?
Growing up, I didn't know any black rugby players, you know. Right. To be fair, there was Paul Sackey and Jason Robinson and Courtney Laws, obviously. What a man. But I didn't see it. You see a lot of the golden boys, Lawrence Dialio, Johnny Wilkinson, Will Carlin, all these players being poster boys. And I think that the times are changing. Like, you think of Mauro Itoje, he's one of the biggest names in rugby in general, and he's doing amazing things commercially in the game. But what I was saying is, when I was growing up in rugby, I didn't have any people that I looked up to and thought, fuck me, I could see myself there. Because no one had opened up about going through what I'd been through or coming from a similar background to me, or not many people who were mixed race playing rugby who looked like me, you know? So, whereas in football, for me, there's a lot of representation, isn't there? And
indeed.
To be fair, I would say in football as well, it doesn't matter where you're from. If you're mint, you're going to get a gig.
Is there a representation issue in rugby because of racism? Or is there just a representation and issue in rugby because people aren't represented enough? Is racism at the centre of that, do you think?
No, I think it's class.
It's class?
I think it's class, yeah.
Right.
I think it's class.
Do you believe there'll be a pathway within the confines of your sport? Just about talent.
Well, I think, to be honest, the sport's quite openly been on its ass for a while, especially in the financial department. So if they haven't got the money to build on the infrastructure and the resource at the bottom of the game, then that's just never going to happen anyway. Yeah, do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
So I think there needs to be a distinct plan. I'm similar to you. I don't think we need to make a big song and dance, but we need more black players. It's not what I'm asking for. What I'm asking for is equal opportunity at both ends of the diet. Whether you got a load of dough to start with or whether you got fuck
that's
all.
That's fair enough, yeah.
Let's look at both sides of the coin, do you know what I mean? Let's not just gear everything towards these private schools and just go there to find the talent. Let's go to the shitholes. Let's go to Northwest and try
and
find
the next talent come out there, because you'll get a different brand of talent.
Let's do it, not just because it's hard to do. I know it's harder to do, but that's why you caught a diamond in the rough, you know? Like, that's where you find them.
Absolutely. How did you feel representing your country?
I'll be honest with you, mate, it happened so quick, I didn't actually think about it. Eddie rang me and went, Ginch, you know who this is, mate? And I was like, no. Eddie fucking Jones. And I was like, wait.
Is that what he said? Eddie fucking Jones?
Yeah, fuck it, why not? And he's a legend. And I honestly thought someone was going to start laughing. I thought it was a wind-up.
Right.
And he said to me straight up, he went, look, I'm going to bring you into camp, mate. He was like, I love what you're about. I love the fight. I love the aggression. Bring it with you. So I did. And played against Wales. Debuted and then went on the Australia tour.
Yeah.
And didn't play a minute for 5 weeks. So that's what I mean when I say it was a roller coaster. I didn't have much time to...
Because I was going to ask you about that. Because, I mean, Eddie was on here and he was a riddle wrapped up in an enigma. right? I sat here asking him, you're going to be the Australian coach? Yes, mate. You're not leaving Australia because all these things have been indexed to you going to Japan? No, mate. I said, categorically, I'm going to stay in Australia as long as they want me. Does the podcast next day, if I can resign and go to Manchester, Japan, right? So he's a riddle wrapped up in an enigma, and he's a fascinating character. But he calls you up into the squad, but he doesn't seem to play you. You know, I look at your statistics. I think it's something like out of the 38 times you could have been available to play for Eddie Jones, you only start 19 of those games. And I think 10 of them or 9 of them were in his last set of fixtures. So prior to that, you're starting like 1 in 4. Yet when Steve Borthwick takes over, you're starting 80% of the games.
I think naturally Steve's taken over at a later stage of my career. So I'm probably a more senior player now. As you said before, achieved what we did with Leicester and had that working relationship. With Eddie, there was already established players there that had just won a Six Nations title with him. And those boys were there to stay for the time being. Whether I was...
Was it nothing to do with he didn't have enough confidence in you?
Was it just
timing?
I think you always got to show a coach why they should pick you. And it's not good enough just doing it in the Prem. You've got to do it week in, week out in training and then perform when you get the opportunity. And at test level, like you need to have experience. I never used to believe that. You really do. So I never used to understand it, but the older I got and the more he started playing me, the change I seen in myself firstly as a man and secondly as a player, I actually started to understand the conversations we'd have. We'd always sit there at the end of a week or at the beginning of a week. He'd send you home on a Tuesday to go play for your club if you weren't going to play for England. Back then with Eddie, he'd say to me, mate, you're not playing this week. And I'd be like, fuck me. I'm playing my best rugby in the Premiership, so that's like the only place I can show you. I'm training the ice down, where I felt I did. I ain't getting arrested and I'm still not getting picked. Like, what the fuck's going on? I'd have some, Eddie, I'll tell you if you ever see him again, I've had some very open conversations with him in that meeting room. We've clashed heads a few times, once quite literally. And he always say, mate, you're not yourself. I can't pick you. You're not being yourself. You're not yourself. You look low on confidence, man. I'd be like, what the fuck you want about? Like, you don't know any of this. I'm full of confidence. I am myself. And he was right. He was right for all those years. He was right. And I used to give him a fucking hard time about it. So if he does watch it, sorry, Eddie, because I used to fucking chew your ear off about it. But he was right. He was totally right.
Well, that brings me on to an interesting dynamic that I found really challenging for my thought process when I was talking to Lawrence Dallaglio about players and their relationship with coaches. And it's manifested itself recently, I think, with Henry Slade talking about you players and your propensity to tell the coach. And I think Lawrence used this expression, we're the ones going out in the fucking field getting our face smashed in. We've got a view on how this should be. Mm. And I'm curious to see how that manifests itself. In football, you've got the coach. He determines the philosophy of how you play. Right, and that's kind of at the end of the discussion. And if you don't fit into the coach's requirements,
there you go.
Off you go. Whereas it seems to be, certainly from what Lawrence was saying to me about the attitude of the England squad at that time and what they would say when they felt that there needed to be something to be said and how they'd want to change. And then I'm reading this bit about what Henry Slade has said about how it was basically the players that have impressed upon the coach the necessity for change in the Ireland game. You tell me.
Yeah. I think he's referring to the Scotland game where we lost and then we played the Ireland game the week after. In the Scotland game, we basically coughed up the ball 22 times, unforced errors, turnovers, dropped the ball, and we lost the game, I think by 6 points. So we had 2 weeks essentially to prepare for this Ireland game. And I think I wasn't involved in this. I'm in the brain stress with the front row, not with the backs, but I think they basically went in and said, look, we need to change something. And Slade's a great player and he moves the ball so well. So he probably did front foot that. I'm not too sure. I went in the discussion, but we then went out and trained and spent, I think it was 50% more of our time in training on attack. And yeah, you've seen it come through. What I will say about that is that if we didn't lose to Scotland in that week, we wouldn't have made those changes.
Right.
So every cloud, as they say, like we wouldn't have changed and I don't know if we would have beat Ireland or not, but the performance we put in was definitely off the back of thinking, fuck me, let's have a look at ourselves.
But culturally, is it a dynamic where the players are able to really express their views about certain things.
So what I will say is, I think, and it sounds a bit cliche, but everyone in rugby always talks about the environment being good. Do you have a strong leadership group? Is everyone comfortable to speak up? And I've been a part of teams in the past where people say, yeah, we do have a good environment. We do have a strong leadership group. We are comfortable to speak up, but no one fucking did. Right. And when you lost, people still didn't speak up because they were scared about what coach was going to say. I think Steve created an open forum when he came in. I've worked with him for ages, so I knew it, and I had to reinforce it to some of the boys because they weren't too sure. But he genuinely wants to learn. If you think something could be done better, he'll sit there and he'll listen to you. If you don't agree with you, he'll tell you. Mm-hmm. But his ego doesn't get hurt in that sense. So I think when that did happen against Scotland and we kept losing the ball, I think the boys probably went to him and said, Steve, we need to do this, and he implemented it. So it's a sign of a good coach, I think. Like you said, in football, like I don't know it too well, but like Pep and those boys, I can't imagine if I went into his office and said, look, Gaffer, I need to play up front this week. I don't know how it works, but he'd probably lose the plot, wouldn't he? Mm. Whereas I think definitely in the environments that I'm in now, it's a bit of an open forum.
Was Eddie good at having these sort of conversations with players? You talked about bumping heads with him because he was saying something to you that you didn't agree with. But as a coach, I mean, I like him as a man and I liked him as a coach, and I don't really recognise some of the things in the media. I do think he's a trickster and a bit tricky, but I don't like some of the things that Clive Woodward writes. He seems to be constantly sniping.
Yeah, you're not alone there, mate. You're not alone.
Yeah, yeah. Why does it annoy you what he says?
I genuinely don't read after stuff because it's behind a paywall and I've refused to pay £1 to listen to him. So I never read the article. I see a few headlines and he says a lot of stuff. I think like rugby's changed drastically in, what's it been, 21 years since he won the World Cup with England. So in that 21 years, you've seen the difference in players and the size, speed,
agility,
everything.
Physical structure has gone
through the roof. You know, like when I played, I would have been a short, fat prop. Now I'm 6'1" and one of the quicker players on the team. So it's not the same game. And I think he won a World Cup. So fuck me, what can we say to him? Do you know what I mean?
Like, does that hang over you guys?
I think what I'm acutely aware of is people. They have to stay. He has to put food on the table. Don't he? I'm sure he got a lot of dough from winning the World Cup, but he has to stay relevant, and ultimately headlines like that do draw clicks and do draw attention, and players will see it. Whereas if you went, England had a 7 out of 10 game this week, they were good. No one would fucking click it, would they? Mm. So I understand it within reason, but at the same time, you have to understand, you make your bed, you sleep in it. You can't say that and then think you're everyone's fucking mate, you know? Because if you do talk about people in the press and scrutinise people, that's what's going to happen. I had it recently, semi-final of the World Cup. The scrum penalty went against me, and there was a bit of controversy about it. And ultimately, that was the 3 points that we lost by a point. Mm. So you do the maths. And that fucking hurt me, you know? And then in the week now, I'm seeing people that speak to me with a smile on their face say all sorts online. So when I seen them, I just said, don't fucking speak to me. I said, I've seen what you put out in the week. I said, don't that my mate now. And they shit themselves. So like, that's, people got to do that to earn their bread. But for me, like if you're I ain't having it, you know, so.
But if it's a fair opinion.
It is fair. It is fair.
So you wouldn't have a needle with it then, would you?
No, I couldn't care less. If it's your job, it doesn't mean I got to like it. It could be a fair opinion. It doesn't mean it sits well with me that you're gonna say the things that you're saying. And to be fair, I think it's easy for people to pick people apart when things go wrong. And very rarely do we hear the press talk about England doing well.
Can you tell me how you prepare for games? I'll tell you why I'm asking. I know it's not like boxing, but the physical contact that goes in rugby is significant. But the more I see it and the more I speak to you guys, the more I like about it because I like the characters. On fight week, when you're talking to a fighter, they're irascible, they're bad-tempered, they're on their edge. Right? What's the mentality of a top-flight rugby player going into big games with the nature of the sport that you're in, which involves, you know, pain and challenge and physical adversity? Is there any parallel between the spikiness and the mental approach and the edginess of a fighter with that of a rugby player?
I think definitely, but it's position dependent. I think for me, front row is combative, it's abrasive. You're probably going to get a bang on the nose in the first minute of the game because you're hitting a ruck, or you're going to get whacked, you know? So I think naturally you have to be quite abrasive, and I think the best players in those positions are. So a young version of myself, I'd watch Mike Tyson clips on the way to games. You know, I'd sit there watching Mike Tyson videos. But that's changed for me now. Having more of a leadership role. I can't be that sat there not saying fuck all, no one knows what's going to happen, bit of a ticking time bomb. So I've changed that now, and I'm a lot more relaxed because I've realised that the energy that I give off to other people will affect the way they play, rightly or wrongly, whether it should do or it shouldn't. Right. It does. And people look to me for reassurance, I guess, because of that abrasiveness and that side to the game. They want to know, right, his head's on it, as opposed to, fuck me, this lunatic sat there watching Mike Tyson put people on the canvas for 15 minutes on the bus. What's going to happen, you know? and I get it. And because other people don't like getting fired right up, they like being relaxed. There's a kid called Joe Marchant, right? I don't know if you know him. He played for Harlequins. He was in the England setup. He's in Stade Francais now over in Paris. Mate, he would be quoting, you watched the film The Other Guys?
Mm-hmm.
And you know when he says, 9:30, gentlemen, let's have a great day. He said that on the way out in the quarterfinal of the World Cup. And I was like, what the fuck? Yeah. Well, I'm so far away from that. Yeah. But he's incredible. What a player, you know what I mean? Like, he'd go out and he'd be the best player on the pitch. So I can't knock him for that. So I think that's where you've got to understand the differences in people's psyche and where they're at, and really get to know your teammates. Because some players, George Martin, for example, the big second row from Leicester, he hits people harder than anyone's seen it. I can slap George on the back of the head. I can grab him by the scruff of the neck, you know, and give him a bit of that. Whereas there's other players, back three players, fly half, scrum half, not so much the physical part of the game. It's more of a, come on, boy, I need you.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And I'm looking at him in the eye, I need you today, as opposed to the physical touches. So I think, very long-winded answer for your question, but I think that's the differences now in rugby.
What did you make of Owen Farrell's challenges recently? He's taking a break from international rugby to prioritise, his words, his and his family's mental well-being. You know, one of your colleagues, your captain.
Yeah, and a good friend.
What did you make of that?
It was tough. I probably knew it was sort of looming over him anyway, because I've asked him, like, you're right, and he'd be like, oh, mate, don't bother me, you know? And you take everyone's word for it. And I think it's good for Faz. Like, he's always ever known as England and England rugby. He's never been dropped in the England setup. And for him to take a step back from it and go away, he's probably going to come back a better player, do you know what I mean? So, and the one thing that doesn't sit well with me is he was always everyone's public enemy number one. Like, if he done something wrong, everyone would fucking jump down his throat. And it's easy to attack him because he hasn't got a massive social media presence. He won't go back at people and in the media because he thinks, like, nah, fuck it, I'll let my player do the talking. And he's one of the best in the world. So I understood his stance, but sometimes, fuck me, you just want to stand up and just be like, have a pop for him, you know? But look, people that jump off a cliff for that bloke when they were playing, like, he's a big motivator. He'd work all day for you, and rightly so, one of the best in the world in his position. So,
do you expect him to be back with England?
Yeah, I could see him in an England shirt.
Yeah?
Yeah, I can, yeah. How old is he now? 31? Maybe 32. Once he signed 2 years probably in France, he could be back, definitely. But naturally, when you're away from it and in England, unfortunately, we've got this rule that I think's not too sharp, is that when you go abroad, you can't then play for your country. Mm-hmm. Because obviously, as you'd know in football, you've seen Jude Bellingham and those players go away to the other leagues and made them who they are today. So I think that rule should change personally.
But it was brought in, wasn't it, to develop young talent and make sure it stayed on these shores.
And I got that.
But now it's not working because of the finances in rugby.
The finances, and I think two or three teams have folded, right? So now there's less teams. So now these young players, both ends of the spectrum, the best players haven't got enough teams to go to because you got a cap and there's quite a small one financially in rugby. And then the young talent don't get a chance to come through because now all the best players are condensed in one place. So for me, it's just
But the primary motivation, isn't it, let's be honest, for these players to go and play abroad is the finances.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Definitely. And I'll say this, and I can imagine it was a big part of the reason Owen went to the French league as opposed to, I don't know, a Japanese team or something, because the rugby in France at the moment is the best.
Do you blame them for putting, I mean, they're putting their finances, and you've done the polar opposite. You've made a decision to go from Leicester back to Bristol because of the principles of the value that you have for the family unit that you need to be around more and what you believe is valuable in your life. So you've put finances a little bit lower down the food chain.
Mm.
Do you blame them? Because playing for your country is one of those just remarkable things that only a few people can actually get to.
Yeah, and it's not always guaranteed. I mean, for O's, it probably was, but for some of the other players who have made those decisions, it probably wasn't always guaranteed. And like I said, to be honest, their hands were probably forced because, like I said, there's three less teams in the league.
Yeah.
So now there's not enough money. That's 50 million less on the cap to go around. There's only one marquee spot now. So if you want a big overseas signing, you can't have an English player as a marquee. And teams don't want England players, really, because we're away for half the season. The structure's changed now.
Right.
I don't know if you've seen it, but whilst the internationals were on, the Prem wasn't playing.
Yeah.
Which suits English clubs down to the ground. But then you've got to think about the knock-on effect to the players is you come back from camp and you just played 7 weeks for your country, boom, you're straight back into club. So, fuck me, it's an uphill battle, isn't it?
Do you think England are going to win a World Cup anytime soon?
Well, 2027 is the next opportunity.
Mm-hmm.
As I said, like the one just gone in 23, what an opportunity we had. We lost by a point. We're leading for majority of the game, so I do think that like the adversity and the hardships of a team do make them better. So
of course, if they can overcome them and learn from them.
You look at South Africa 2015; they got knocked out in the group stages, didn't they? Mm-hmm. And then they went on to win two on the bounce. So I think we've done 2015; got knocked out in the pool stages at home World Cup. I wasn't a part of that.
2019 semi-finals, 2023 semi-finals,
exactly. Yeah. And then 2019 final, 23 semi. So bronze, silver, knockout.
Did you guys feel the ambivalence from the nation?
What does ambivalence mean?
Ambivalence means kind of, well, we think you're going to stink the World Cup out. You went into the back of this last
World Cup. At the beginning, yeah.
Did you feel that when you were over there?
Yeah, in a big way.
Because it was this low level of expectation.
But like I said, like if you go to a restaurant, 9 times out of 10, people only leave a bad review if it is shit. If you get like a... if it's okay, then they don't really pipe up, do they? So, I mean, like you always see the bad. You never really see the good. The filter's not there. So I can imagine there were loads of fans that were always behind us and supporting us, but we only, and fuck me, it's tough. Like you lose at home to Fiji. It's never happened before. Suddenly all the bullets are flying. But it's crazy because in camp, we were like, fuck it. We know where we're at.
Mm-hmm.
We know what we're building towards. We got the evidence to prove it. And I think we shut a lot of people up. And then on the flip side of the, what was the word? Ambivalence.
Yeah, disinterest.
On the flip, means, on the flip side, sort of the ambivalence. Yeah. We then seen everyone get behind us, and it was amazing.
Yeah.
Like we've really felt that. So it was nice to see the tides turn, but we had to show them, didn't we? Because I'd be the same. Like if my team's losing at home and they never lost to a team that routinely you should beat, especially at home, and you're saying that you're going to win a World Cup, then I'd have some questions to ask as well. So I understand it, but I quite like the idea of embodying it and using it as a motivator, as opposed to trying to ignore it, you know?
Mm. Last question for you. You were on a Netflix series. Did you enjoy doing it? And do you see yourself doing any kind of sequels anytime soon?
Yeah, Guy Ritchie movie next year. Did I enjoy it? I didn't enjoy it at the beginning. I was really standoffish. I didn't want anyone to come into my home. I didn't want anyone to come to my house. I wasn't comfortable sharing anything to do with my family. Weirdly enough, I started filming shortly after that my own documentary.
Oh, did you?
Yeah, but you can imagine I spent a lot more time getting to know the people that I'm filming with them, as opposed to Netflix texting you saying, can we come down today? It was tough to start with, but look, I think people enjoyed it, and I think this second season is coming next year, at the end of next year, and I think it's going to be even better. So hopefully, I understand the value that it has for our sport, and I want rugby to do well. And I think like it hasn't been well documented over the years, and it's probably why it's failed to come off the platform. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So in short, yeah, I've enjoyed it because of what it's doing, but the process was a bit of a sticky one for me.
Well. Done all right today?
But now we're here, yeah. Look at me now. Ellis. Sweating my tits off.
Very much enjoyed it, mate. Thanks for being so
top
up front
man,
with me.
Thanks for having
well
me.
Done, mate.
Cheers.
Up Front with me, Simon Jordan, is brought to you by William Hill.
For new weekly shows, subscribe to our YouTube channel. You can find audio episodes on Spotify, Apple, or wherever you get your podcasts. 18 plus, please gamble responsibly.